Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
どこいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ。どこにいるのかな。見えないよ。
あ、こんなところ。
America is finally having an ongoing conversation about gun violence. In the wake of last month's school shooting in Parkland, Florida, and driven by the energetic political action of countless students across the country, it feels like there could be real regulatory action taken for the first time since the federal assault weapons ban went out of effect in 2004. Unsurprisingly, those that would prefer to dodge such regulation have, in searching for an alibi for gun violence, pointed again towards video games. Those, of course, are the words of Austin Walker, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 144. Joining me today, of course, are Rob Zachney.
Hello, hello.
Patrick Klepek.
Hey.
And Austin Walker, who wrote the introduction, of course, for this week.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good. Normally, we have a whole discussion about what the topic is going to be in a given week. But this week, it was really easy because we actually had sort of a theme going. All during the week, we wrote pieces about the relationship between guns and games. Now, we were talking about pizza and Sbarro before today's podcast.
It's
and there was some gold there. But I feel like we have so much of a topic here since we all wrote or edited, at the very least, a piece about guns and games this week. I thought maybe we can make this theme week really work and do the podcast about
that. So you don't want to talk about how Canada has both chains called Boston Pizza and New Orleans Pizza?
What?
Is that not? It's not. Okay.
All right. Well, look, we're going to talk about guns, but first, I think we do need to interrogate this. We need to interrogate this.
I don't know what's going on up there. You know what? Maybe it's there is a culture of guns in Canada too, but
sure. They
don't have the same violence problems that mass shooting problems that America does.
Sure.
Maybe it's the pizza. I don't know. Correlation
is causation. Is it because they eat bad pizza? Is that what you're trying to say?
It could be. I don't know. Correlation, causation. That's what I'm hearing from the Trump administration.
Bad pizza is like sort of soothing for a populace.
I didn't mean to do a common verse there. Correlations, causation.
That's
what I hear from the Trump administration.
Hey,
anyway.
You know you're a poet, and it's good.
Apparently.
And it's very good.
Anyway.
Okay, well, now that we've established that Canada has less gun violence because they eat bad pizza, I feel really good about where we're going with this. Like, first couple minutes of the podcast, and we've already got like a good correlation causation thing going on.
Uh-huh.
It's really, really good. I mean, I guess that leads really easily into the topic that Patrick wrote about, which is about correlations and causations.
That's true.
So here we go. We're going to ride this little segue like it's a Canadian skateboard and go right into that. So, Patrick, you wrote a piece. A Canadian skateboard is a thing.
Are they different?
Huh?
Are they different things?
I don't know. You lived
in
Canada.
I thought the implication there was that the segue is the Canadian skateboard.
That's what I was trying to say, but...
Is it a different type of skateboard than a skateboard from another country?
Look, you lived in Canada. I don't know. I've only been there once.
It's better on the snow. That's the difference.
Okay, that's what it is. Okay. It's a snowboard-skateboard hybrid.
Hybrid,
it's beautiful.
Yes. Got it.
Patrick, sorry. I'm sorry about everything. You wrote an awesome story this week. You interviewed an academic who actually has actually done the math, basically, who has done the actual studies in terms of not showing necessarily a strong correlation between violence, violent behavior, and video games. Do you want to talk a little bit about that piece, like where you found this gentleman and how you kind of thought about writing this story?
Yeah, you know, when we were sitting down trying to figure out, you know, sort of pieces to potentially write for this week, this was kind of spurred by the meeting that Trump called, you know, kind of bringing in video game executives. And so there was like a couple stories being written about that. And there was one in USA Today that was, you know, talking or speaking to the supposed thread between video games and real life violence. And one of the people quoted in there was this research psychologist and professor and book author, Patrick Markey. And so he really seemed to know what he was talking about. And, I, you know, what I... the question I was thinking to myself was that we take for granted the concept that science has proven out that there is not a correlation between violent video games and real life violence, or at least not one that is meaningful to society writ large, that should sort of shake our thoughts about video games as a medium, despite their preponderance of violence within them. But I couldn't really speak to like the specifics, and didn't really know like what it meant other than the conclusion. A lot of that is because, you know, when academics speak, academic papers is very difficult to parse, like what that all means. And the book that Patrick Markey co-wrote called Moral Combat, which you can find on Amazon, it's with a C instead of a K. For that, it's written in plain language. It's written in the kind of English vernacular that allows sort of your everyday person to understand the science and how we got there. Yeah, my conversation with him, which was a podcast that went up on Monday, and then there are some excerpts in an article that went up at the beginning of this week as well. I was basically just kind of talking through that science, like walking through some of the contradictions, walking through some of this researcher's own assumptions about the correlation. I mean, what he spoke to specifically was about how some of his early research, because he's been kind of following this for more than a decade, was not so much that he was drawing a link between aggression and or rather violence and violent video games, but was looking at sort of the emotional reaction, which sometimes can show that there is like a mild amount of aggression, but was not found to be dissimilar to like if you watched like a really like action-packed movie that you were into, or like your sports team loses. Like there's lots of media that causes an emotional or short-term reaction, but that's very different than causing violence or explaining mass shootings. And so we talked through a lot of that, and really what I found most interesting about the conversation was a lot of the stuff that I didn't really understand, which was like both how like those actual experiments are conducted. Like, how do you actually gauge right. the emotional reaction? Like, what are they literally doing in the lab that allows them to draw these conclusions? And then things like walking through the different mass shooters, like both at Columbine and Sandy Hook and other places where video games have been brought up as a sort of talking point. But what actually we learned, like, for example, in Sandy Hook, I actually ended up laughing during the conversation because I was so taken aback, was that there was the Sandy Hook shooter did own things like Call of Duty, and so that began that conversation about like, oh well, you know, geez, like I wonder if these violent video games are some sort of connection there. He played a lot of this Call of Duty, which is like, an incredibly popular game. It's not a particular, it is violent, but like a lot of people are playing this violent video game. But more to the point, what they later found once they did their like sort of like tracing over his steps, like they kept seeing him go to this movie theater, and they couldn't figure out why he was going to this movie theater over and over and over again. And they later found out, like talking to his peers, that he was obsessed with Dance Dance Revolution, which just made me cackle because it's so counter to our like general understanding of how we talk about games and violence. And the last thing I would posit that that took me by surprise was we were talking about the kind of research that goes into this question of video games and the correlation with real life violence. And I wondered, like, in the is it, you know, I said I am proposing to, I don't know a lot of how the funding works, but my guess is the funding goes to where politicians allocate it. And if the question is beginning with, do violent video games cause real life violence? Isn't it possible that we're led to a significant amount of possible conclusions, even if they're in the minority? They end up becoming seemingly more than an outlier because the research that's being funded is research into that question, as opposed to research that is counter to that question or around that question. Right. And the thing he said was absolutely, it was like, if politicians are going to fund money for do video games cause or violent video games cause real life violence, you're going to end up with more studies that end up drawing the conclusions that are a little more problematic, because those are the kinds of things that you can get funded. So people are going to seek out that funding. So it creates sort of this like vicious cycle that the it was weird. It was interesting. It was a really fascinating conversation.
It's interesting because I think that conversation and this, you know, one of the questions we get, and one of the questions I think we always internally have is, okay, if the science does show that video games only create this sort of like temporary boost in aggression and not anything that would lead to violent action separate from other causations, separate from other right. situations, how then do we talk critically about guns in games? And more importantly, I think that there is like at root a sort of nihilism that we have to contend with, because there is a line of thought that I've seen this brought up in response to this series, which is if guns in games, if gun violence in games doesn't lead to violence, then is there no connective tissue from content to behavior, from content or theme or idea or anything that's being put forward in a game to any sort of outcome, then why do we care about what is in our games at all? Why do we want positive representation of diverse characters? Why do we want games to tackle complex issues like death and sexuality? Why do we want games to do the things that we see in other media? Why can't games just be the place where guns, happen very well, right? Like where gunplay happens. Novels are really good at introspection. Novels as a fiction in general is a place where introspection happens better than in film, better than in video games right now. Why can't video games just be the place where gun violence is a core thing that's done well if there's no connective line between behavior or viewpoint and the content of the games? I think that has been one of the most because it's difficult, because when someone has that perspective, there is a lot of groundwork that needs to be done to get them to care about anything. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. That person is often just looking for an alibi to not engage with the issues, but often even when they're in good faith, there is something really scary about that notion of like, well, if none of this fucking matters, then like, why, if none of this matters anyway, then what would even a game that has interesting or positive or positions in line with what we do feel matter? And I'm curious if any of you have had that sort of, internal struggle as you write about this stuff, as you edit stories about that stuff.
I mean, something that I've sort of been turning over in my mind this entire week is that I think the answer is like, these things are worth discussing because what's happening in our culture is interesting. The nature of the fantasies that we cherish and that resonate with us are always interesting to sort of inspect and consider and sort of wonder, what are they putting in our heads?
Right.
But I also do kind of wonder, there's an element, like, the way this has often been brought up in political discourse, for instance, is as a kind of red herring. But even more than that, like, even discussing it critically, is there also an element of diffusing responsibility to the point of meaninglessness? That,
right.
Oh, it's not just that guns cause problems, but that we live in a violent and gun-obsessed culture. Our entire media, our entire, the entire American entertainment industry is obsessed with that stuff, and that's the real problem. And maybe that does have an effect, but also it's not like playing Call of Duty is mass producing ARs and selling them in gun shops across the land. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's an element of, obviously all the stuff matters to some degree. These things like do sort of ripple outside of their immediate context. But at the same time, like, there's a lot of people who make it their business to manufacture a lot of firearms and ammunition. Uh-huh. And a lot of other people who sort of get by in elections helping defend the interests of right. people who profit by this.
Right.
And so, like, it's to me, there is an element of this that is a little bit resonant of, like, you care about climate change, but I can't help but notice you drive a car to work. And
totally,
it's like,
totally.
Like, that contributes to some small infinitesimal degree. But the structural problem is that maintains this toxic status quo is actually attributable to a somewhat narrow group of actors who have the power and interest to safeguard the current status quo.
Does that mean that the kind of goal is to challenge I often think about the brick wall analogy for change, right? Or for work in general. It's an academic thing that comes up a lot. As a grad student, you realize that a lot of the work has already been done by other people, and that a lot of that work has not necessarily led to any meaningful like effect in the world necessarily. And one of the analogies you're given is like, okay, well, listen, you're never going to build the wall by yourself. What you're going to do is contribute a brick or two that eventually produces a wall, and then combines with other walls to slowly shift the way that culture happens. You take a look at the ways in which academia is one of the walls in which the ideas around gender have changed across the last century in the West, right? It's not the only wall. Other walls exist that have nothing to do with academia, and no one person built that whole wall. Some people contributed a lot more bricks than others, but bit by bit. And so I think one of the ways in which we do challenge the gun culture in America is by building the wall in our space, producing the bricks inside of our space, and hoping to discourage the tight relationship between game makers and arms manufacturers that exists, the tight material relationship that exists in that way.
And speaking about publishers at this point, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about publishers here. I'm not you know whoever is making a game in there. I mean, but also those people, right? Because there's the other way of thinking about it, which is they might not have the material relationship with guns, in terms of like paying money to license Heckler and Coach
Coke.
Cock Coach Coke Cock.
I always said Coke.
Coke, Heckler and Coke, like MP5s or whatever. The fact that I know model numbers of guns is like very clearly demonstrating a lot of how this culture works. The fact that I have favorite guns despite not being a gun person, like that's wild to me, right?
That Ruger Mini 14, baby.
Right. This is the thing. Like people have that. That's like I just finished playing through Far Cry 5. I can't talk too much. I can talk a little bit about it because the streaming embargo is up today, and that's the weirdest fucking thing. The review embargo isn't until Monday, so I can't give any final thoughts. But if I was streaming the game right now, I could obviously be talking about what I was playing. But like, I played.
Just have to have it on
that
in the background while you say this. Just make sure.
Exactly.
Just make sure.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Look, I'm holding a controller.
There it is.
Currently.
I see it.
Look, it's even energized. Look, it's orange.
It's orange.
It's
the right color.
It's energized. Yeah. It's the Energizer battery color. I played the most of Far Cry 5 with a gun that's like not good because I like the design of it and I like how it reloads and I liked it was like a lever action receiver, like a repeater rifle basically. And it's like, oh, I like this thing. I'm like, what the fuck am I talking about? You know what I mean? But also, I like the thing. I can't retreat from that. I have to engage with it. And so the other way to think about this is to encourage developers to, push themselves to find ways to create that feeling in me without me holding a gun. And does that make sense? Like, that's part of the work I think we're doing here. Cameron Kunzelman's column today was like a fucking... Cameron and I were up very late last night. Like, we threw out two drafts of that thing and started it completely fresh, basically. And he gets to that point. So make sure to go read that today on the site, because the takeaway ended up being about, like, The takeaway ended up being there was a point last night where we were just like, we should just kill this whole piece. This whole piece is trash. It's like, we can't fucking do it. It's gone. And I'm like, we just like went back and forth. And finally he was like, really the thing I want to get at is that video games have too many death wishes and not enough Black Panthers. And I was like, oh,
nice.
Why did you write that like 3 days ago? We wouldn't be in this situation. So go read that piece. It's up on the site by the time you hear this.
Yeah. So with all of this, I'm always going to be the person who gets really introspective and really navel-gazy because, of course, everything has to be personal with me. But I always wonder, and I want to put this as a question to sort of the room here. It relates to the piece that I wrote as well, which we already talked about on the last podcast a couple days ago. But how do you feel about your own sort of power fantasies that relate to this stuff, right? Like, you're saying a little bit about this, Austin, but I'm always, like, really weirded out by my, like, good guy with a gun fantasies, right? Like, I don't think of them in that way, right? But that's essentially what they are. I have the same sort of military fetish that I think a lot of nerds do, where I love watching Battlestar Galactica and looking at the uniforms and looking at how cool and badass people are.
Or even beyond that, we've had a lot of conversations about, like, you want to be a good person who can save the world. Like,
exactly. I want to be action hero awesome.
Yeah.
And that, in our culture, 90% of the time involves having a gun in all of our media, across games, across movies, across TV. Again, I don't think this is a symptom of games exclusively, but it, of course, is something I think about all the time. Why do I think women in uniforms are hot and have guns? Like, why? Why all this stuff, right?
Good question.
And,
same.
Well, like, I mean, I'm not saying we can all answer it. Right, no. They are. There's something fetishistic about the way we look at militarization, like, in our culture. And not even just militarization, of course, but, like, having that power to affect change, a.k.a. take people's lives, right? That's so much of what we do in terms of entertainment.
Yeah.
I wonder how you guys wrestle with that. Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the thing. The brick wall is, like, the least, appealing thing in the world. Like, right. Cool. I did a little tiny bit of a thing that may never lead anywhere.
Yeah.
But, like, the general who commands, Rob, you can probably talk to this better than me. Like, the general who commands a battalion, the sniper, who holds the fort down by themselves against all odds. Like, oh, look at how obvious this is and how powerful it makes me because I can do things quickly, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of that we valorize people who create something, like the idea that great people can come along and create action from nothing, create outcomes from nothing. It's the we valorize people who create a new status quo, but like the idea of maintaining or improving or building those brick walls is never valorized at all. It doesn't come up. People actively try to avoid that work. And I think, like, that's perfectly understandable because I think the, like, series, like, maybe, you know, from what I've inferred, some of what Far Cry is doing is this idea that it's alluring the idea that there can be an enemy that we can then just pick up a gun and go defeat, and then everything's going to be cool.
Yeah.
It will be great. That is really, really alluring because the truth is we don't agree on nearly as much as we'd like to think. Even among people we consider our allies, you get down to the brass tacks of like what you all envision for the new status quo to replace the one we've got. You know, what shape will that take? You'll discover a shit ton of, you know, fracture points. You'll discover a lot of tensions that have to be negotiated, and it won't be fun. It'll suck. It'll turn friends slightly at odds with each other. It'll cause tons of compromises that nobody wants to make and that aren't cool and sexy. Or you could cross the Rubicon with your army and sweep aside the old order and put everything right in one go and then cut to credits. You know, just like immediately, like hard to black.
Are we talking about John Bolton here?
Yeah. I mean, yes, right? Like, that is the thing. Is like, so this is the thing.
I mean, like, like, go ahead. Bomb Iraq, bomb
the road
North
to
Korea.
Democracy goes through Baghdad.
Patrick, can you actually speak a little bit about John Bolton? Like, I don't think this is, I'm not being facetious. Like, I think that that's a perfectly good topic of conversation given the subject and like given the direness of that appointment and given the larger question of like, what is the culture? How does the culture get made? And as Rob said, how do key people get put in place and wield power in a way that is dangerous? And how does culture like prevent us from engaging with that shit and stopping it?
Yeah, I mean, Trump recently announced that he's going to replace his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, with John Bolton. John Bolton, who I think for a lot of people who are like millennial age may not like fully like remember or like it'd be plenty of reason for you not really understand other than like he had a bushy mustache and he worked for George Bush, but he was like, one of the chief architects of, chief architect of the Iraq War, like is someone who has predominantly over his career advocated for the use of war, first strike in order to sort of rather than like slow diplomacy. It's like, well, you strike first and then you figure out, what the conclusion is in the rubble later. And you would think that, like the complete failure of the Iraq war would like maybe whatever my begrudgings with a lot of like Republicans and neocons are, like, at least there's been some acknowledgement. They're like, I guess that didn't totally work the way we meant it to. If that's not like the full acknowledgement I'm looking for, like it's at least one step in that direction.
I think you're kind of half imagining that step, buddy.
Yeah.
I think this is, there is an impulse. I want to say in liberal circles to see the faintest acknowledgement of the magnitude of their fuck-ups from the right wing as like, ah, see, this is maybe somebody I can reel with.
There's a human like, behind there. A little bit. There's a human, maybe. Is there a human? No? Yeah.
Right, like...
all I'm saying is, like, it's still bullshit, but at least, like, the performance is that there is some sort of performative act in the age of Trump to like, ah, whereas like with John Bolton, he's like, nah, fuck all that. Like recently written, like in the last like 2 years editorial saying like the solution to North Korea is a first strike military option. Like the thing to the way to get rid of Iran's nuclear bomb is just to bomb Iran and is paid to go to Iran to speak on that topic of regime change. Like that is like the idea that is John Bolton through and through. He's not even doing the performance of maybe there were lessons to learn.
He took money with MEK, just, right?
Yes. And so he has been installed as the national security or will be next month or the next month as national security advisor to Donald Trump and brings with that, you know, that ideology, that mentality, and like it essentially like the idea that like the U.S. can solve everything through its military might will just go in, sweep out the bad guys, put in the good guys, and it'll be fine. And like 16 years into the Iraq War, like that's not how it works. That didn't work in Vietnam. Like, come on, like and like that does speak. I think that speaks to like John Bolton is like the neocon like fucked up. Like extremely far right version of that. Even though, like, when we talk about Battlestar Galactica, we're thinking in Nazi terms of like, there's a good guy, there's a bad guy. The good guys just come in, get rid of the bad guys, and it's all fine. And like speaking to Rob's point, like actually, it's a whole lot messier and bad and compromised. And like the idea that you just swoop in with American military and it's all good. Like there's very little, no proof that that's actually how it works.
Well, like, and it's funny because there's something in that fantasy of the good guys come in and sweep in and take out the bad guys that is a conservative fantasy because the notion is that the problem is a tumor or is a cancer on the status quo. I'm about to write a lot about this with Far Cry 5.
Yeah.
That the villains, the bad guys, if in removing them you protect you make things better. That means that the state before the bad guys were there was A-OK. I get frustrated a lot with liberal pundits who talk about Donald Trump in this way, right? Who frame Donald Trump as a uniquely malicious line of attack from the right that as if he doesn't share traits or as if he is not the logical extension of a larger ongoing thing. Sorry, my whole computer just like blacked out for a second. I got very worried.
Okay.
they're hacking me now.
You also buzz like the rebel comes in Star Wars.
Okay, good. That's good. I hope it's not on the file. We'll see. There is a line of thought inside of certain liberal circles that Donald Trump is a uniquely malicious, a uniquely cruel version of, a unique thing versus being an extension of long-running policy ideas, long-running ideologies. And he isn't like, I want to be clear, there are things that are unique about him, lots of them, but he exists inside of a context and inside of a continuity of ideas that already had a place.
He's saying the soft part loud in the Republican ideology, the Republican orthodoxy has been saying, you know, dog whistling. Saying there's a reason they say that, you know, you say the soft part soft because you don't want other people to hear. And Donald Trump just said it and then capitalized on it. But it doesn't remove him from the general tumor, like cancerous, like ideology that existed for decades.
Right. And so the difference there is that, like, I think getting rid of Donald Trump, having Trump impeached, finding out what, listen, Mueller, like do some work, like keep hustling, homie.
And
I think that's
too
important.
So,
yeah, he's also listening.
He's
and
on
I
this call.
Listen, totally. I think getting rid of him would be a good thing, but that does not address that the underlying factors are still fucked, right? Like getting rid of Donald Trump does not bring us back to an imagined post-racial state.
Right.
Like those people still voted for him. And I think that gets out again what Rob talked about, which is that the guns are a wedge issue. People vote on guns. Gun culture is supported by an entire network of cultural production. we grow up, I grew up having a, if I grew up in a slightly different world, not only would I have favorite guns, I would care about having access to those guns, right, and would be, you know, very easily pushed into voting so that I would have access to those guns. Even if that access would actually maybe not be under as much threat as was being, told to me. And once that happens, that is how you get to John Bolton being appointed. Right. And so it isn't, I mean, here's the funny thing is like the fantasy of the immediate change, the fantasy of the, we can fix this with a gun, is itself a brick in the wall of conservative ideology.
Yes.
They are moving slowly. They're moving super slowly. You can go back and look at some of the work that Newt Gingrich did as in the 1980s when he was like at think tanks, and what he's doing there is setting up the future dog whistles. Like there are literally documents that he wrote. You have to understand that like that Gingrich was part of an academic heritage actually that goes back.
Well, it's like the Koch brothers like established decades ago, realizing if you establish think tanks, the think tank sort of movement in the GOP was a response to perceived liberal bias in academia,
right,
which was that the only way to respond to like the liberal socialization of culture was to make up like your own other side of it, and so the
100%.
Response was for the Koch brothers. Go read. There's a great book called Dark Money that like gets into the whole history of this. But like essentially, what happened over decades was like you set up these think tanks, and then they're around forever, and then you put those people quoted in newspapers. They go on cable news, and like they just put out academic papers that push an ideology that sounds legitimate because it's being presented in the same way that like academia happens.
Well,
and then, yes,
this is the thing that's so wild to me about Gingrich specifically is he actually comes out of a Marxist heritage.
What?
His it's
oh,
wild.
Really?
His,
I did not know.
Yeah,
that.
So his yeah. his Marxist is probably a Marxian, let's say, heritage. His one of his mentors was this guy named Alvin Toffler, who was a futurist who was concerned with labor rights and labor activism, and specifically about technology. He ended up being this person who was advocating for the post-industrial society, for, you know, moving away from mass production, Fordist style production, and moving towards kind of service industry stuff, more technological revolution stuff. And Gingrich ends up taking a lot of those ideas and then in the 80s building them out to being about ideology, and specifically like here are the phrases that we need to use in order to start slowly changing the frame of debate. And the gun rights was a huge part of that. Like gun rights was a very specific, I mean, this is one of those things that I think, again, like we are all very young people in the scope of American politics. And it's wild to think that in our lives, the gun debate was invented. Like all of us are over 30. And so there was a time when we were alive that the gun debate barely existed compared to where it's at now. The NRA only became the NRA of our modern imaginations when a sect inside of it threw a coup and change it from being a group about like sportsmanship, a group about like gun maintenance, to being a political organization.
You should go read, like, if you have not read about, there was some podcast I listened to that like did a thorough, but like go read about that moment.
Was it
when
Planet
the
Money was, what was that? That was a
was
fairly
was
recent
Planet Money or something like that. But there was go to research for like about the moment when the NRA switched from being like a hobbyist organization and was just co-opted by a bunch of people secretly, and they flipped it in the middle of a meeting in a way that literally was
it's
a coup. It is
unbelievable.
You will not believe it because it sounds unbelievable when it's told to you.
This is fascinating and so upsetting.
It was Radio Lab from last year called The Gun Show.
Yes.
The Gun Show.
Worth listening to.
Wow.
I believe The Gun Show is part of their Radio Lab separate podcast.
Oh, you're
called,
right. More Perfect. It was
More Perfect,
Perfect,
which is a really long analysis of like court cases like related to race, guns, sex. Go listen to that
More
podcast
Perfect.
If you find any of that stuff like interesting. It's
gonna be listening
always,
to this today. Yeah.
Yeah, you should definitely listen to it. As always, their stuff is like super interesting if you're coming at it from the left the way I think a lot of us are, which is like you can see where they're still like a little bit in their way, but also every now and then you're like, oh shit, like you really went there. What was there was a This American Life recently that went someone is in a loud motorcycle
listening
outside.
To you,
what
Austin.
Is happening?
They are listening to you.
They are. There was a This American Life recently that went somewhere that I had, like, I was, there was this whole thing about, like, it was like an anti-centrist This American Life episode.
What?
It's literally about, like, going hard at the Dems picking up the kind of more radical elements that bubbled up during the last election. It was unbelievable. It was really, really weird. Go listen to that.
I have homework anyway, for this week.
Yeah, I'm giving everybody homework.
Yeah.
God.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I do want to ask, I mean, this is fascinating, and I need to do a lot more homework, absolutely, on all of this. I do want to ask, and this is the hardest question maybe that we're going to have, before I get into questions, because we do have some really good questions as well. What do we do about this as players of games, and what do we tell our fans as players of games who might enjoy playing shooters, who might enjoy the feeling of a gun, or the way a shotgun feels, or that kind of thing? What do we do? And this is a question that comes up constantly, right? And I know the whole thing about no ethical consumption under capitalism. I get it, and I'm there. But also, this is the world we live in. This is the field that we work in. What do we do about it? How do we do this dance? And how do we rectify things to the degree that we can where we are right now?
And I think it's doing this, right? It's talking about it. It's like actually just like rather than like running away from the contradictions, it's like embracing those contradictions and like wrestling with like the messy emotions and react. It's like, yeah, it's like being able to look at a game and to be like, man, that's a sexy reloading animation. Like, that is fucking cool. But then realizing, like, that's okay. Like, yes.
Why do I think it's cool?
It is a good reloading animation. But, it, like, it's – and I think that's fine, right? Like, you can have – like, those things – like, that's why, you know, seeing some of, like, the gaming's worst actors, like, and the way they've talked around, like, the work that we've been trying to do this week, like, pulling out, like, conclusions that we're not trying to draw. It's more just saying, like – there isn't, like, it doesn't fall in one way or the other. It's more just saying, like, it falls in a lot of directions, and, like, we can ignore it, or we can just say, shit's messy, and, like, let's try and work through, like, why it feels messy, because that doesn't mean you can't, like, I'm going to sit and enjoy a bunch of violent video games this year, but, like, I want to talk about, like, why I enjoy those parts, or maybe what part of those, like, I need to more closely examine, and, like, you know, that's, I think there's nothing wrong with that, but you can still love games and be like,
Totally.
One of the stories I worked on this week was about how the Picatinny Rail changed how both how guns are depicted in video games and the way they are marketed and made. The Picatinny Rail is basically what, and this was a piece by Kelsey Atherton and Ian Boudreau, who wrote for us this week. They did a great job on it. But basically it was an attachment point that was like a standard component that was added to rifle barrels so that people could, for instance, like sling a flashlight on the underside of a firearm or place a laser dot sight on it or attach whatever optics they wanted. And so it's why, like, the M4 carbine, if you see, like, soldiers and police carrying it, often has a very different appearance, might vary from individual to individual based on, like, how people have customized it. And that's made its way into games. And one of the reasons this story interested me is because that is not just a neutral thing that happened. Like, there was intent behind that. Some of it was functional. Some of it is the gun is just a device. Like, the gun is just a device that fulfills mechanical function. Its context varies a great deal. But these were functional changes made to guns. But there actually was sort of a method and intent behind the shift in gun culture as well. It transformed guns into custom vanity items in a way they hadn't been before. It allowed gun manufacturers and sort of after part makers to create sort of a, to intertwine a user's personal identity with their fucking hobby in a way it had never been. Yeah. Like, suddenly, yeah, everyone had their rifle before that, but, like, suddenly this really was, like, your AR-15 in a way that it was not other people's. The same thing we see happen over in video games, where it's this move toward tons of gun cosmetics. Every gun now is customizable. Do you want, a rare sight, a vanity skin, all these things. And to a degree, this is just, you know, people like cool shit that, you know, if you're a gun owner, you're like your gun to be a little more personalized and maybe look a little more what you think looks badass and ditto in games. But at the same time, there's an element of, if you're not careful with that, there's a reason people want you to invest some part of yourself in this thing, in this object. Like, there's a way of getting you to invest more of yourself than you otherwise would have into something that was previously just functional and commonplace and everyday. And suddenly it's part of you in a way it wasn't before. And that's a powerful thing. Like, that's something we should be mindful of and awake to the ramifications of.
That's identity, right? Like, that's the difference between, yeah, like, and that's like the shift, right? Like, that's what the, like, going back to the, yeah, the NRA shift, like, it was a shift from, like, helping people manage a hobby to an identity. Like, guns became part of who you are. And maybe that was true for some people, but not nearly to the degree that it was when the NRA made a shift. And I think the customization culture, which obviously plays out in both real life and video games, is part of that. I mean, hell, that plays out in video. Like, that's Gamergate. It's gaming as an identity. And, like, that's when things you love or appreciate, like, that's when it gets dark and dangerous, when it becomes part of your identity, because then it becomes inexorably tied to you and what you represent and how you're presented to the world, and that's when shit gets really weird really fast.
And people can turn it on you, because, like, if you're not aware of that, you're not aware of the degree to which you become invested. You've not knowingly,
yes,
become this tied up into something external to you that previously you didn't have this relationship with. And you might uncritically think, like, hey, this is just the status quo. Like, this is always how it's been. What do you mean there's a broader, like, this, what do you mean there's a broader context to all of this? This is just the shit I like. This is just what I do. This is just my hobby.
Right, right.
Except somewhere along the line, somebody changed your relationship to it. And if you're not hip to how that happened, then you've opened sort of back doors into your psychology that weren't there before and you're not aware of. And that's just dangerous. And I think that's one of the reasons it's worth examine everything, like, be critical of everything. It doesn't mean that because I fucking have a lot of feelings about the look of my weapons in Destiny, for instance, when I do play Destiny, that doesn't mean that, like, I'm complicit in a culture that, like, has created mass shootings. But it does mean that there's a part of me that is in dialogue with a broader context around guns and violence and how we relate to them. It's not a causal relationship, but it's something to bear in mind and to always question whose interests these depictions serve and what their sort of hidden curriculum is. What are the lessons that they're sort of imparting to you that you might not be aware of?
Totally. It's funny because, Danielle, you actually wrote a piece this week that is about the opposite, which is someone who became hyper aware of the content of their games and, like, specifically the ways in which guns... It's a really great piece. The ways in which
team
guns...
effort you all helped edit, so thank you.
Yeah,
thank
of course. But that's every piece. Like, I want to be clear, real quick.
No, I know.
I moved the graph. Not,
no, but for people listening who don't know this, because, like, this is a conversation that bubbled up this week in on Twitter.
Oh yes.
There are often people who help make a piece come together that are behind the scenes, yes, and who don't get a byline. Editors don't get bylines in this industry. If you touched a piece, it doesn't go on the... It goes internally, so that if someone fucked up, there is repercussion. Like, you have to fill in a thing on our back end that says who edited a given piece, so that if there's a mistake there, the higher-ups can hold that person accountable.
That's why I always put Austin Walker, just in the field.
I mean, you don't even need to. Anything that goes on the site, that's on me, like, at the end of the day.
By the way, Austin, you changed your password recently. I need you to update your credentials on my PC.
So that's the thing, is we're all just using one account. It's like when you work retail and you can't be fucked to, like, actually log into the register. You just use your friends who stays logged
one, two, three, four.
And your count is wrong at the end of the night, and it's like, well, who fucked up? Who's your register $20 short? Why is this person's name wrong in this article, Austin? Yep. Like, anyway, my point is, everybody touches a lot of article, or like not every article necessarily, but a lot of articles have multiple people on the back end, doing, you know, editing, doing copy edits, doing structural edits. So even though my name might not be on every piece, or Danielle's name isn't on every piece, like a lot of us are working together on these things. Patrick just helped me put together the Ian Williams piece on game unions, which you should, or on the kind of push towards unionization.
And Danica, like, constantly, you know, is helping with headlines, constantly doing copy edits. So
100%.
Routinely catching uses of language that I don't have the eyes for, yes. Helping me like get phrasing to be a little more precise and sensitive.
Totally.
Like phrases, super useful shit.
You know, lots of great phrases like fit are added and explained. Anyway.
Palico's fit.
But anyway, the point, Danielle, is that you wrote about someone who actually did the opposite thing, which is became hyper aware of guns and games. Can you talk about that a little
absolutely.
Bit?
Absolutely. And it's interesting. So just to give the quick background, in case you didn't, I talked about it a tiny, tiny bit the last podcast, but I interviewed Ben Burbank, who was a friend of mine. I'm friendly with him. He works at Campo Santo. He used to work at Double Fine and has for years actually always tried to play games sort of pacifist, and not just games, but shooters especially, Call of Duty games, Far Cry games. You know, he cites Destiny as well without ever firing a gun. And he's kind of always done this and always kind of just found it more interesting and more fun to do this way. But in 2015, his family, his wife, and I think he has two children, they're okay. I have to always preface with that. But they were at the scene of a mass shooting. They were directly threatened by a gunman in a parking lot. Apparently, his wife was actually really close to the shooter. She saw him and she ducked at like the right moment kind of thing. So he got this text message that just says, I want you to know we're okay, but we were just involved in a shooting. Like, we almost just died, basically. And his kids are young. I think his son was 6 at the time of the shooting. He's 9 now. And I believe he also has a daughter who's even younger. And he says, I have not felt comfortable at all shooting a game, like squeezing the trigger on a gun in a video game since that happened. And they were even involved in another sort of close call, which is so ridiculous and so insane. But there was another – they were involved in sort of a lockdown at a park where there was another gunman sort of running wild. So really, really terrifying stuff. And Ben's a really thoughtful guy, the smart dude. You know, he's a programmer for game development and has always, even for years, sort of always tried to implement solutions and other gameplay solutions in the games he's worked on that don't involve guns, basically. This was almost like proving his point to a degree in like, you know, a near tragedy or two near tragedies were almost sort of proving his point that he's just uncomfortable with guns in games. And he just thinks like, hey, you know what? There's actually more. Both, it makes me feel weird because of what's happened in my family, and also it's more interesting and more fun to do other things in games or to find those other solutions in games, even games that are meant to be shooters. You know, Call of Duty, the primary mechanic is walking forward and shooting. There are, you know, there are other mechanics, of course, there's other modes of interaction, and he prefers to use those. But yeah, just sort of finding the tricks and the fun ways. And there was actually a really fun little quote he said where, hey, devs, like, put an achievement in your games, even your like violent games, even your games that are about shooting. Put an achievement in there for people who like never want to shoot your game. And that'll be like almost like a little reward. Like, that'll be cool. You know, these are actually ways of making your games more interesting and engaging that just happen to not have to do with guns. And he's not, to be clear, he's not like a 100% pacifist player. He's like, yeah, you know, melee attacks are okay, that sort of thing. That's how he got through Destiny, for example. But yeah, it was just really interesting, interesting perspective. And holy shit, I'm friendly with him, and I didn't even know about the near shooting. Like, I didn't even know that part.
Right, you just knew that he like, oh yeah, he does this sometimes.
You know, when I was basically asking him because talking about this piece, it was actually a little bit more nebulous of a piece. It was going to be, you know, various people who play pacifists and sort of getting why do you play pacifists? That's interesting.
Still a good idea. Yeah. If you play pacifist games, write in.
I'm interested.
Talk to Danielle.
I'm interested. But when he kind of told me why he plays pacifist now, as opposed to kind of how he's always played pacifist, it was like, oh, I think I have a topic here. I think I have like a more narrow focus. So
it was really interesting to see him talk about like if he ever did make a game with guns. Like, that definitely was for me the thing that stood out. Like, it would have to be a game where I think, what was his exact, do you remember his exact phrasing?
I can pull it up, but it was basically like, I only ever shoot once and it really means something. That's paraphrasing.
Yeah, like it changes the world completely, you know, if you pull the trigger. And that's one of those things that's like, the other thing I think we can do from our position is to encourage developers to take those risks and make games like that, and to talk about them when they do, like, both as journalist critics, but also as fans, right? Like, push yourself to go play things that use guns differently. Patrick, you wrote about Receiver this week, a game that takes guns from like a whole different position, and a game I think that's probably slipped out of the public consciousness a little bit.
Yeah, it was an experimental game jam game that came out in 2012. If you're familiar with like the Rabbit 3D action game Overgrowth that was in development for like 7-8 years, it was doing early access before games even had thought of that as a sort of a business model. And anyway, one of the game jam games they did in mid development was the designer David Rosen did a game called Receiver, which was fairly popular at the time when it came out, and has been kind of been forgotten a little bit because it was 2012 and they haven't built anything on the game.
I can't believe it's been 6 years since Receiver. Man, what is happening? Yeah.
And the concept behind it was that he, when I chatted with him, like, he grew up a big fan of The X-Files, and he wanted to dress as Fox Mulder for Halloween 1 year, and was able to go on a database that, like, listed, like, the specifics of, like, Mulder's character, including, like, the gun that he had in specific episodes, and he managed to buy a toy replica of one of the guns that Mulder ran around with, and like, you know, pulled it apart and was like playing with like the springs, and like just like ended up like realizing, oh, there's a lot more to guns than just pulling the trigger. And so for his game jam game, he wanted to sort of like convey that feeling like in a game somehow. And so Receiver, which is like a very simple sort of roguelike, you're just with a very limited sort of narrative framing, you're kind of just like fighting off drones and turrets while exploring this kind of like nondescript warehouse, and you have this one gun that you spawn into the world with, and what's different about it is that instead of just hitting reload to you know, put more bullets in the chamber, or into the clip rather, or is it magazine? I get the terms mixed up. Anyway, to get more bullets, it's not just hitting R and like watching an animation loop. You actually have to, you know, like pull the gun apart, individually put more bullets in, make sure that it's chambered. It's not, and like once you put the bullets in, it doesn't mean that like you can just hit fire. You actually have to chamber the bullet. When you spawn into the game, it randomizes like the way the gun is set up. So it's possible that you load into the world with no bullets.
God, I forgot
in
about
the gun.
That.
You can load into the world where you've got the bullets in, it's in the chamber, and you fire and nothing happens. Oh, right, that's because the safety's on. And it's the idea that he wanted players to just think about guns as like a complicated object that is not as much, it's not just left trigger, right trigger, or like point the mouse and shoot. Like, there's actually a lot more that goes into them. They are like a complicated objects. And yeah, it's interesting because he sort of at the end said that now that Overgrowth is out, and given sort of the conversation that's happening around gun violence, gun culture, like he wonders if there's like a world where like taking the lessons of Receiver as a game jam, like if there are like broader implications for like a more ambitious game design. So he's gonna take a closer look at Receiver and see if there's nothing more he could do with it. Because I do like it. When I was looking, I was hoping, when I originally was thinking of the idea, I was like, oh right, Receiver was like, it did that, surely more games have done something like that since. And someone has pointed out there's a VR game that actually does like play in the same thing, which I could imagine VR, where you actually have these controllers where you can like individually play with the intricacy of a gun. I could see that being like really fascinating. But still, like, by and large, like, video games have not engaged with the idea of treating like the gun as an object as more than just the left trigger, right trigger, and you know, hit R to reload. And I think there's definitely a space for you, at least at the very least, like understanding the complexity of the object that we have simplified in video games.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was another piece, not about that specifically, but about sort of guns as cultural objects that went up from the folks at Bullet Points, that gets at least some of that weight, if not the specifics of how Receiver also works. So yeah, lots of guns and games this week. I'm not going to ask our first question because I think we actually already addressed it in Patrick in what you were talking about in your interview. But I do have a couple questions here related to Guns and Games, our theme this week. This one comes in from Daniel in Kentucky. Daniel writes, after the announcement of Far Cry 5 being set in Montana, I started seeing comments about how that seems boring compared to the locations in previous Far Cry games. This left me with conflicting thoughts. On one hand, I do want to see the vibrant locations I haven't seen before in video games, and I want to have fun in them. On the other hand, it does irk me that the only times I see locations I want to see are in violent games like Far Cry or Hitman. He uses an example. Do you think this is an odd situation as well? Isn't it weird that in games like Far Cry or Uncharted, you're trying to kill people in a beautiful and interesting cultural locations?
Yeah.
Sometimes in these games, I wish I could just stop and enjoy the views that developers put a lot of time into creating, but I can't because I got to go kill that next enemy. Thanks and take care, Daniel in Kentucky. Oh, yeah.
Those other games got to sell more so they can get the budget.
Yeah.
Right, that's like that's, I mean, that's the terrifying thing, right, is like so much of this does come down to budget and risk and an industry that is risk averse. Ubisoft, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Assassin's Creed Origins just launched that education mode, right?
But I think that's right. Like, that's actually, like, if we're talking, like pragmatically, what is more likely to happen, it's
right.
Not that the, you know, Gone Homes of the world. I mean, that game sold well, but I mean, like, sort of like, sort of like writ large. Like, it's not that, like, those types of games are going to suddenly, like, click and just start selling tens of millions of copies and we're going to get, like, really expansive, like, nonviolent worlds. I think it's actually more likely that we are to see, like, how can these games that are able to pull off the budget and scale that we want, like, it's awesome that you, and I liked Assassin's Creed Origins, but, like, what I like even more is that they thought, well, what's a different way we can repurpose the world that we have built? And so, hopefully, that what Ubisoft did in trying to create sort of, you know, an educational layer to their game is, like, I'd love to see more developers repurpose what they've built for violent means.
Yeah.
It's like, are there ways that we can rejigger this world in different ways, present it in different contexts that take advantage of, like, the only reason we can justify building this is because people are going to jump around
right.
Shooting things. So, like, are there other ways that we can reuse it in a way that accomplishes or at least, you know, does something similar to what Ubisoft is doing? I think that's more likely to be the outcome than
the other
stuff.
Did any of you ever play The Hunter?
No.
I want to say this was so it was made by like a small team within Avalanche, I want to say, and I think it was using the like Just Cause 2 engine, but it was a deer hunting game.
Huh.
Or at least that was the free mode. Eventually you could like buy licenses to hunt other things. You could go like boar hunting in that world, or turkey hunting. But it was, for its era, and I would still say is, just a gorgeous like outdoor wilderness sim in a lot of ways. Like you spend a lot of time like tracking deer, like looking for trampled grass where they might have bedded down, you know, tracking deer shit, you know, where did they browse leaves in the forest? Like, you know, you can tell where they've been feeding. You sort of go up and you sit real still long enough for the deer to feel a little more comfortable, and you hear the deer start to like call to each other and you know where they are. And I don't know if they ever did do a nonviolent mode, but like, the act of actually shooting, like you were going through this world with a rifle, but it was like a single shot rifle, and like it, like setting up for that one shot could take like 30, 40 minutes, right? Like,
right.
So it was the whole experience of just being out in this really gorgeous, you know, forested island, which I just totally adored. But it also occurred to me, like, there was nothing about that that had to be inherently violent. It could have been like an outdoor nature photography sim in
right.
some ways, right? Like, I think you made that today with a good photo mode. You actually could make a really tense, gripping game around that, right? And you apply this sort of stuff to a lot of different settings. But I think the trick is walking around a really nice recreation of Montana sounds fucking boring to me. Like, I mean, it sounds nice. I would love that for like 20 minutes. And I'd be like, all right, that's, oh man, look at that mountain in the distance. This is amazing. This is great. Wish I could hunt somebody in here. Like, but there needs to be something.
Somebody?
Yeah.
Did you say somebody?
Once or told me.
Oh my God.
Anyway.
Oh no.
But
oh, no.
The point is, you need something to engage with in that world. Like, the fun thing about hiking is that hiking is exhausting, but also you're constantly picking trails and trying to navigate and like
right,
finding your footing.
Right.
You need something to mentally engage with, so it's not just a trip through sort of an airless open world nature museum, because that's not
totally.
Fun. It's not actually cool the way nature is.
Two things. One, there was a sequel to this game. It came out last year. I'm surprised you haven't played it.
Also, there's an expansion for the original, or the new one that involved dinosaurs.
Wow.
Which, okay.
Yo. That's awesome. Okay, that's all right, cool. So the new one is called The Hunter Call of the Wild. It's funny because like the way they sell it is actually it's actually in line with what you're talking about. Like they say, experience the thrill of the hunt. This is just like the little short blurb. Experience the thrill of the hunt in a visually breathtaking, technically groundbreaking, vast open world. Immerse yourself in the atmospheric single player campaign or share the ultimate hunting experience with friends. But even then, like in like the long bit where they was like feature. Like, yes, the first thing is a next generation hunting experience where they go into all of the immersive shit. But then it's like explore a vast open world by foot or ATV. Explore 50 square miles of varied terrain. Take on missions and challenges from the locals or go off the beaten path. Discover lookouts, hunting towers, and outposts. Like, ride this ATV. Exploring the open world has never been more fun, etc. So I think it's interesting that they are also selling that thing. They recognize that in the original that was part of the appeal. The second thing I want to say is actually about Far Cry 5, because I finished it last night. Again, can't get into final thoughts, I guess.
Again, he's playing it right now
And the thing that I'm doing right now is I'm actually playing my favorite part of the new game, which is not about shooting anybody. It is about exploration. And it gets to what I... Is there a duck outside? What is happening in my neighborhood?
Shoot it. You've got Duck Dynasty listening in.
The Call of the Wild is here. Bum, 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 bum. Grainy photo of a mallard. delivery of, like, an arms shipment out of the back of an old Mercedes SUV.
I'm haunted today. So my favorite thing in Far Cry 5 is actually them finding a new verb or reconfiguring a verb they already had in new ways. Because Patrick's right. One of the ways we're going to get these things is by big budget games appending a non-violent or a non-gun a chill mode. Hashtag chill mode. Catch me on Twitter. all right. There is a situation that I'm going to say right now. I'm not going to say what the situation is, but you'll know my life has changed in major ways if you ever catch me with hashtag chill mode in my Twitter bio. So that's one way to do it, is the Assassin's Creed Origins educational experience expansion thing. But the other way is for developers to play with new primary verbs other than I shoot him, right? Shoot is one of the most... Shoot and jump are basically the two biggest verbs outside of just like walk or move inside of games, especially games where you embody a character. The things you do there are shoot and jump. either you're Mario and you're jumping on things, or you're Mario and you're shooting things, which we'll get to
in the next question, actually.
Yeah, it is. And so one of the things to do is as a developer, is to like look for ways to add different things to that, or to play with those things and diversify them. And Far Cry 5 actually does it in a really great way with things called prepper stashes. Which is like, what a fucking bad name. But so the biggest
puzzle stashes.
They're puzzle stashes. The biggest thing for me about Far Cry 5, all said, that's not the biggest thing. It's a messy, messy, messy game. We'll get to it on Monday and have like a long talk about it. I should have a review up on Monday if this weekend goes the way I hope it does. But one of the biggest things is they got rid of the towers. They got rid of the towers where you add stuff to the map by climbing a tower and seeing everything. And at first, I thought that was just about game flow. I thought you climbed a tower. Climbing the tower in the past was the way that you added things to the map, and so by getting rid of them and kind of having this more organic system of like, oh, I go talk to a person, they add a quest to my map. They say, here's a shrine to go blow up. They say, hey, there's a cursed deer to go kill or whatever. Not cursed, but like drugged deer.
I heard this guy was building a teleporter.
Right. That is one of the quests.
This morning.
Maybe Far one Cry? That's like, yeah, 100%. I heard that maybe the piss tape was here.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
There's a piss tape quest in that game. The piss tape. You recover the piss tape in Far Cry 5. And then you give it to Donald Trump. This is not a joke.
Yep.
What?
This
spoilers
game.
For a tiny side quest in Far Cry 5. You give it to the CIA, to a CIA agent who's loyal to Donald Trump. It's not good. Anyway.
It sounds funnier than
I hope we made 1,000 copies.
No, it's the opposite. Journalist. It's like literally you are doing the job of making sure it doesn't get out.
Oh, boy.
Anyway. The other thing that getting rid of towers did is it freed up the developers to use the elements from the towers in different places in that game. So previously, on top of being where you get your missions added to the map, towers are also the place where players experience verticality. and where they experienced light puzzle solving, light kind of platform puzzles, where it's like, okay, how the fuck do I get up this thing? Like, okay, where's the next, like, blue, like, rope hanging that I know I can climb up to? Where's the grapple point? How do I, like, unpack this little puzzle in my mind? And those are gone now, because towers are gone now. And so now those can go other places. And so the world is filled with these stashes that are puzzled, that are little puzzles, but they're also, like, now, because they're not just all towers, they get to be environmental set pieces. They get to do, like, a little bit of environmental storytelling in a way that I did not expect at all. And so some of them are very basic. Some of them are just, like, okay, you know that there's, like, equipment inside of this prepper stash, but the door is locked, and the door, and the stash is flooded, and so you need to turn on the power to get the door, and then also drain the water from the stash.
Drain the swamp.
So you go down and drain the swamp. You have to drain the swamp. Thank you. And that was, like, basic. But there's one that I found, a lot of them are not basic. Like, this isn't an exception. The bulk of them are not basic. One of them is just a haunted house you walk through, and it's like...
You know, they feel like the vaults in Fallout.
Yes.
Without being nearly as expansive.
Very
as what
small.
Bethesda did.
Yes.
But they feel like they're riffing on the same thing, where it feels like there's a little bit of storytelling and thematic trappings on top of, like, you know, whatever platforming you're doing to get to it.
The best place that they show how people reacted when the cult, like, decided to do the reaping. So there's, like, one where you find a note that's just like, we keep sending, like, it's from the cult, basically, that's like, we keep sending people after this guy, he's too good, like, we can't get in there. And you like and he has a key to get into his stash, and we want the stuff in the stash. And so you do this sort of, like, Far Cry, like, turn to 11 version of the McNulty bunk scene from season one of The Wire, where you're just like, fuck. Motherfuck. Or you're just walking through his house and seeing, all right, so he turned and killed this guy here, and then this door was broken down, and there's a dead body over here, and you're, like, walking through his house, and you're like, fuck. Okay, and then they figured out that they chased him upstairs, but he barricaded the door, so they went outside and put a ladder up against the porch and climbed that, and they went through the window. Oh, that guy got shot in the chest with a shotgun. And then finally, you find his body, and, like, he's up against the wall, and you get the key, and he, like, killed the guy at the same time or whatever. And then you go to his stash and get extra perk points or whatever. But those things are so good and do such a better job of giving you these little snapshots of what the world was, or, you know, what is in these people's lives. There's one where it's just like, you definitely find a note, and then it's a lot of, like, you have to suspend your disbelief to some degree about, like, the note that you find that like, sets up the thing. Where, like, there's definitely one where it's just a guy talking to his girlfriend who's like, no, trust me, I watched all the electrical engineering videos on YouTube.
I just did that one.
And it's like, oh, this place is going to fall the fuck apart. That one's really good. Like, it actually feels like Half-Life 1 a little bit, in that, like, or, like, Half-Life in general, there's all these, like, set piece explosions and electrical wires and, like, I didn't expect it to do animations or, like, you know what I mean?
It's a very unique little bits as opposed to just, like, hey, there are 30 of these stashes with perk points set aside, and I'm like, go find them. You walk in, you open a door, and there's your shit.
And I would do a game that had double the amount of those and half as much shooting. It's called Breath of the Wild, and instead of having like little story things, they're just like more complicated mechanical shrines. But those are the things, basically.
That makes me
That's the other. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll talk on Monday.
Okay. All right. Yeah. This will come back on Monday.
There are bits of it I love, and there are lots of things that are messy and not good.
Just one thing is our solution here to slowly, like, yes, you can use guns, but, like, is it to keep Watch Dogs 2-ing games to some extent, right?
Where Watch Dogs 2 Watch Dogs 2 doesn't go far enough.
Right.
I have, like, I'm so deep in my fucking armchair designer bullshit with Watch Dogs 2, and I hate that shit so much, except that I'm going to let myself have it, which is, I wish there were no guns in that game until one of your friends gets killed. And then your dude is like, I'm getting a gun and I'm killing these people. And that would have felt like a real moment of characterization for him if he'd spent literally dozens of hours being nonviolent. And also, I wish that game had actually made nonviolence, like,
an option.
And no, it is an option. It's totally an option. But actually, I guess the other way. I wish violence had actually been reprimanded in some ways, disincentivized. I wish, like, killing people meant anything in that game, because it doesn't. Yeah. Like, you can go through that game, to your point, Rob, by not killing anybody, and by using stun guns, and by using your cool little yo-yo attack ball. But you don't actually...
But, like, imagine that, but, like, it's combined with a Dishonored type thing where, like, the world is changing because of what you're putting into it. And also, your characterization is changing. That, like, this is actually is a genius thing about Dishonored 2. Emily Caldwell is a fucking different character if you start, like, letting fly too often, right? Like, if you are going through the game like a fucking ruthless killer, Emily Caldwell turns into a different person over the course of that game. You can hear it happening. That is a cool thing. I think maybe the way we pull this off is, like, you sort of leave possibilities open, and then you start designing some narrative wrapping around people exploring those possibilities, and then something becomes an avenue for expression and meaningful moral choice.
Right, this is Undertale also, right? Mm-hmm. To some degree, am I the only one here who's played Undertale
the first
all the
3 hours.
Through?
No, I have. I beat it.
Okay. Yeah. You beat it, or did you get, like, the good ending?
Yeah, I did the passage.
You did the whole, So I think maybe is that also a model, right? Which is, like, because part of the reason that, like, Dishonored 2 is a great example, except that nobody played Dishonored 2. Not nobody, but not enough people played Dishonored 2. I didn't.
This is me throwing a table.
I like Dishonored 2.
Right now. Call me by Arcane, okay? Thanks.
Okay.
Did you beat Dishonored 2?
Not yet.
See?
But I put, like, 65 hours in, okay?
I'm going to throw the table at yourself.
65 hours of Dishonored 2.
Just slam your head on that table.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
62 hours?
Something like that, yeah.
Jesus.
That's what I'm saying. Like, even if I haven't finished all of those games, I have finished it for what normal people play it, like, 7 times over. So, you know.
So, but like, the only problem there is, like, that's the problem. Is, like, even we didn't finish Dishonored 2. And that is, how do we get people to play? That mechanic has to be in a game like Call of Duty, where, like, lots of people are just going to love it for the shooting anyway, and then afterwards go on GameFAQs and be like, why didn't I get the good ending? And find out.
I think you can do that within the frame of an Assassin's Creed. I think Assassin's Creed is kind Assassin's of Creed quietly and- maybe even moving that direction. Like, it is supporting a little
thematically.
More. Yeah. And also, like, I'm finding it supports slightly more considered play than it has in the past. Like, not that those avenues weren't open in earlier Assassin's Creed games, but it was so easy to stumble into going loud that, like, you could be, like, doing sort of sneaky, targeted, like, killing this bad dude stuff in Assassin's Creed, and then, like, you just turn the wrong corner or you glommed onto the wrong thing, and suddenly 50 people were dead. Like,
right. Far Cry tries it. There are a number of times in this game where someone has been like, if the only language you speak is violence, then I'll speak violence back, I guess. And, like, I can't. The two things I can do is explore prepper stashes and shoot you. That's it. Like, and you're not a prepper stash, so we ain't exploring each other tonight. Like,
oh,
that's
shit.
Really all I can
that's
say.
That's a more interesting game,
so,
for sure. Right there.
That's
right
a different
there.
Game. That's a different game.
Far Cry my name. Like, that's all.
You draw me like one of your French girls. Explore me like one of your prepper stashes.
Wow.
Far Cry character.
Wow. Uh-huh. Wow. I don't think we can top that. I think that's, explore me like one of your prepper stashes. There was another question, but I do think we actually got to it, which was about AAA games, why they always come back to combat. And we kind of actually got there with how we talked about Far Cry. Last thing I'll say about Far Cry, other than the fact that I also enjoy me some good Far Cry, usually going fairly pacifist, but that's one of... Ben Burbank from my piece is one of his favorite series. He actually sent me a follow-up email that was like, oh, wait, I really want to tell you this. Like, Far Cry games are so fun to play pacifist. They're just chaos simulators.
Well, it's not pacifist.
My kids watch me play it.
Right?
Well, like,
it's no guns.
Fire isn't a gun.
I mean, I don't think he's actually killing anybody. I think he's running, like, I think he's just running into situations and running out of them, basically, and seeing what happens.
There's no, because he has to be, if he's beating those games.
I don't know if he's beating them,
he's like,
to be honest.
I think
he's, like, enjoying the open world and seeing what
bananas
shit he can make happen, but without killing anyone or doing that sort of thing. So, yeah.
People die, though.
I mean, you know.
He talks about explosions.
You want to make an omelet, Austin.
You got to break a few outposts, people.
You got to climb a few towers. That's all I'm
saying. Yeah.
I mean, we could keep going, but, you know. We gotta do other things.
I think
things.
We might, yeah.
We gotta do other stuff.
Today, I still have a lot to do today.
You got a lot to do. You got a lot to write. You have to write these thoughts that you're streaming about right now as we're finishing up our podcast. So, does anybody else have any other thoughts they want to add about this week or about Guns and Games or about Far Cry, I guess? Or we're feeling good?
I think
feeling
we're good. I think I'm good.
Oh, yeah. All right. That's cool.
Well, I would say if people enjoyed, like, we've done... This wasn't like a formal theme week. Like we've done stuff like that in the past. This is sort of like a soft theme week. We didn't like, you know, didn't really have time to get like a
get
original
art
for
and
stuff
it.
Like
yeah.
that. But I personally like really enjoyed the focus. And if people dig stuff like this, like let us know what you liked, what you didn't like, what you would like to have seen more of. Because I think we'd like to do, I think it turned out pretty successful. Given the fact that we kind of put it together in like a week and a half.
Yep.
And yeah, or if people like have like different topics we like to explore, or like if you find like an event that's coming up that I don't know for some reason we didn't think like was something that would be a waypointy, like give us a heads up, because I think we're always looking for stuff like that. So
Awesome. I also enjoyed this week, so thank you all for helping to make it happen. Of course. Everyone, thank you for listening to our wonderful show. You can always send questions or comments, as Patrick is saying, or ideas, to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. As always, shout-outs to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And you can read everything that we write, including all of our gun-related or, you know, guns and games-related content from this week at waypoint.vice.com. So, Austin, where can people find you online?
They find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker.
Amazing. Rob, what about you?
Rob Zachney.
How about you, Patrick?
You can find me at the Sabaro Shooter.
Good. Bringing it back to Bad Pizza. Badpizza.com.
Is it?
Yeah. It's, I don't know.
It got me through college, but I can't ever eat it again.
I don't know, man.
There was a Sabaro in, I always say Sabaros. I don't know why, like a possessive.
That's a Northeast thing. Yeah, we do that in the Northeast. Like, I do that too sometimes. Let's go to Nordstrom's.
Like, there was a Sabaros. Like, right. Totally. There was a Sabaro's in our the student union or like the student center or whatever. It's the only thing open past like 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. or actually past 8 p.m. And so like if I was going to eat food that I didn't have in my dorm already, it was going to be from the Sabaro's, and that meant it was going to just tear up my whole
inside. That pasta's not al dente.
That pasta ain't pasta, baby. I don't know. Don't sue me, Sabaro. Mr. Sabaro.
The Sabaro Truther just posits, are you still hungry? Nope.
True. Fair.
Yeah. You can find me at Danielle or I. I'm sorry. I'm a little bit of a snob when it comes to Italian food. I'm going to put that in quotes.
Only the Olive
part.
Garden.
Yeah, the OG. Hey, all right. If we're talking about getting you through college.
I would go to Olive Garden.
Olive Garden got me through college, for sure. I ate a lot of Olive Garden in college.
Good. That sounds all right, honestly.
Danielle went once and said, if I just don't leave, I could just keep eating the breadsticks.
Baby.
That's true.
I ran a lot of miles in college. I was a cross-country runner. I ate so many of those breadsticks. All my PRs in college, thank you, Olive Garden breadsticks. Thank you for keeping me alive and running way too many miles. I appreciate you, Olive Garden. Thank you all. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Olive Garden. Thank you, all our writers as well, our freelancers this week who made this week awesome. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to tell you to be good and be good at it.
When you're here, you're ACOG.
Peace.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.